Hi, I'm Koshin Chris Kane, abbot of the Puget Sound Zen Center on Vashon Island, Washington. We're glad to be able to bring you these podcasts. If you'd like to learn more about our Zen Center, please visit our website at pscc.org.
Good morning, everyone. Great to be here again. I appreciated Jim's introduction using the term great friend, and that's how I feel about many of you. So it's really a pleasure to be here again. And as I said last time, I was here just 2 weeks ago, I'm still not familiar enough with the forms where, like just now, there was a bell that was ringing. Am I supposed to talk now? There's a freshness that brings that I really appreciate. So I do want to talk today about work I've done in the prison. And Koshin asked me to do this, I think, in April. And due to some scheduling difficulties, we are getting around to it now. But I think it's still relevant. And I think it's relevant even though going into a prison and working with inmates is not necessarily how everyone wants to practice or how everyone should practice, but I think the basic ideas of how we interact with other people in this situation or other situations are pretty universal, it seems to me. I got involved working in the prisons in Minnesota, where I'm from and practiced for many years. And it's not something that I sought out. It kind of happened accidentally. I don't think I ever would have sought it out, just because it seemed it just was so remote and a bit strange. But a friend of mine in the Sangha worked in the office, and he was answering the phone when a prison chaplain called and said, "Hey, we have this group of, I think it was seven guys who want to practice Buddhism. Is there somebody from your center who can come and lead the group?" And my friend said, "Sure, I'll do it." And then later he said, "Hey, Jeff, would you mind helping me with this? Would you like to do it too?" And I said, "Sure, I guess," not knowing what it would be like, because it was something that was pretty remote from my experience. It turned out, though, to be truly one of the best practices I've ever taken up, and something that has, it's not an exaggeration to say, changed my life. Early on, I encountered a teaching that has helped me throughout this work in the prison and elsewhere. And that's the title of the talk today. Basically, that my liberation, my opening to life, is not separate from that of other beings. And so if I go into the prison or someplace and think that I have acquired something that I am going to offer or bestow on these people, that's not how I see it, and I don't think it goes well when we practice that way. But if I have open to this teaching of no separate liberation, and I go in and share the practice and inquire of myself and others, how is it that our lives, our liberation is deeply intertwined? And how is it that we can create a space for us to practice this together? And that's how I've come to approach and appreciate prison Dharma work, and that's how it has supported my practice, I think. So again, it's not something about helping the less fortunate or the people that have strayed from whatever norms that society puts forward, although that is the case. But it's really about, for me, understanding that we're all in this together and that they are no different than me fundamentally, and they're but for my own privilege and my own set of karma conditioning, go I would could easily be there. And so this is both a challenging position, but also I can just go in there and be myself. And actually, I think that's one of the things that I've received from my prison Dharma work, is that realizing that I don't have to be different than these folks allows me to more totally be myself and to actually open to that teaching of no separate liberation. Liberation happens between and among us. It's not to say that people in prison haven't behaved badly. Many have, maybe not all, but many have. And it's not that boundaries shouldn't be held, and it's not that we don't need a justice system, but it's more that we are all in this together. And I don't know about you, but earlier in my life, I would have dreams where I would have done something horribly wrong and think, oh my God, I've just totally screwed up my entire life because I will be, you know, put away somewhere. And so I guess I had a fear of that, and knowing that, and I guess part of that fear is that if we do something, we cross a line and we are irrevocably a different class of people, and we are labeled in a certain way, treated in a certain way. And it's that fear of maybe actually being such a person and maybe doing something that would cross that line that perhaps caused some of those dreams for me. So again, coming to these guys, and these are men that I've worked with, and coming to the realization that they are no different than I am. Because when they come to a Buddhist group, and this is my work in the prisons has involved leading Buddhist meditation groups, and so this is an offering through the religious services program. And the guys that come are really guys that have decided they need to turn their life around. They need something. They want a practice that can open them up and ground them and serve them for the rest of their lives. So they've already had a shift in their perspective. And they're coming to a group saying, we're looking for something, we're looking for a practice that can make a difference in our lives. So that's a great, you know, that's always a great place to meet people. When people come to you and say, we're looking for a practice, and then I have to say, well, I may not have the right practice, and I'm always looking for it too, but here's a practice that we can do together that seems to help and that opens us up to something larger than our own small self-centered life. I'm using this term liberation, and so I should say a little bit about what I mean by it. And I think in general I mean, and I think it means, liberation from our sense of being isolated and separate and vulnerable and heading toward death, etc. Not that there is an aspect of truth to those things, but it's not the whole story. So liberation into something larger, liberation from our fastly held ideas of self and other, into a more fluid, more, less certain, less fixed notion of how we are in the world, how self and other exist and manifest in time. And this sense of liberation, if I may be so bold, is not, I think, just experiencing a state of meditative absorption and, you know, going into a state where it seems that nothing is there. I think that is a useful skill and a useful experience to have. But I think what we're talking about here is an experience of simultaneously being separate and connected, separate and together. So that this sense of separateness is there, but it's fluid and it's changeable and it's only true from one point of view, so that we can interact with the rest of the world. So it's really, as I think most of our practice is about self and other and how those two work in the world, in our life. So when we sit down in a circle with these guys and share enough so that this sense of non-otherness emerges, I think we are, we all take a step toward this experience of liberation. And I know I do. And so that I receive much from my work there, from my practice there. And we always say, and I think it's really true, that I get as much out of it, we volunteers get as much out of it as anybody there does. I do think our practice calls us to, and I think all of you would agree, to get off the cushion and engage with the beings of this world, to engage with others, to test, to investigate this fluidity of self and other and how we can participate in it. And so this is one opportunity that arose for me and that has meant a lot to me. I don't think it's the only opportunity, certainly there are many, but this was a good fit for me. So the basic message that I'm, the basic teaching that I'm offering today, the basic insight that has helped me is that my liberation is deeply intertwined with the liberation of all beings. And so it's especially important to go into the prison with that sense, I think, because, you know, a lot of the guys there have a pretty well-developed, you know, bullshit meter. And, you know, some guy just comes in and tells them, well, this is the way it is, you know, this is the way you should be. They're kind of just going to turn it off. And if you're lucky, they'll just walk out. Otherwise, they may cause a little trouble. But I think if we offer them the notion and the practice of, let's do this together, then they really respond, because they're being honored and recognized as human beings, and equals in an important sense. And I think it's one of the things that I love about this practice is that we do it together. And it seems to, it happens together, I think. And even now I'm just up here jabbering, but hopefully in a few moments we'll get a chance to have more of an exchange. And I think when we create ways for the truth to emerge among us, that's where my heart lies in practice. So in the Dokusan room, it often happens. People will bring me, share something, and I will have no idea. I will have not thought about it before. But together, with the conversation going back and forth, some insight emerges. And it's not mine, it's not the other person's, but it emerges there between us. So we call it sometimes the truth happening place. So the truth happening place is here between us and among us. And to create a practice that honors that and allows the experience of the truth to emerge from that is one thing that I deeply believe in. So we actually liberate each other in this way, and I think just opening to that insight itself is liberating. And, you know, it's not like we don't have to necessarily have some big thing happen, but if we sit down with that idea, then I think we're a long way along the path. Because if I have this idea that I have to be a self that is improved to such an extent that I can go in and meet with other selves and help them improve themselves, then I'm always measuring myself and comparing myself and somewhere wondering, well, am I really that's this person? So this idea of mutual liberation sweeps away the idea of the self-improvement project, right? So our practice is not about the self-improvement project. It is about going beyond the need to be an improved self, I think. Going beyond it to this field of mutual liberation. Again, if I feel like I've acquired something of value, that I go in and say, well, I have acquired this thing, and here's a little bit of it for you, a little bit of it for you, a little bit of it for you. You know, you can see that that's kind of a stinky way to approach it. And it also has me being attached to this thing that I believe maybe I have acquired. And that's, I think, a problem for us as human beings. There was one guy in the prison in Minnesota. His name was Maurice. And a black guy from a disadvantaged background that was in for, I think, some drug-related offense. We often don't know the offense for which these guys have been imprisoned. And it's kind of protocol not to ask, but sometimes it comes out and they're telling their own stories. And so that becomes kind of interesting sometimes because there are all kinds there. But Maurice once said to me, you know, when I first saw you, you look just like the judge in my trial, the jury members in my trial. You look just like the people who put me away here. And that's how I responded to you. He said, I can't remember the exact words, but just something as simple as, now I see you're somebody different. You know, you're not that set of people. And for me, I had, you know, he at first was just this, you know, black criminal from another world that I was unfamiliar with. But, you know, encountering him in this way, just he just became a human being, and he became a Buddha. And that moment did change my life, because it just opened me up to a different way of relating to people, I guess, and showed me once again how my preconceptions about people limit my ability to engage with life. So together we, in the prison work, when we don't slip, when we catch ourselves, we're continually asking, well, how is it that my liberation, my freedom, my going beyond the small self is intimately intertwined with all the people in the room, in this room, in the prison room, or in any other room? And for me, it really shifts my sense of how to engage with the people around me. And we don't really know what this means. I mean, my liberation is intertwined. I mean, what does that mean, really? We don't know, but it creates a pathway. It creates a sense that we can explore and continually be open to this fact, and continually see how my tendency is to believe that I have my own little self to work on, and that's my business, and you have your little self to work on, and that's your business, and we don't really meet. I think that attitude is part of what holds us back. But there are several wrinkles in this way of approaching this practice, and again, it's not something that everybody responds to. I want to read a couple of emails that just from this week in our Sangha. A week ago yesterday, there was a celebration in one of the prison sanghas, and they call it Buddha Fest. And Genko, I know, you know, I worked with Genko, and I know Genko is part of your group now, which is wonderful. And she may have shared this term with you, but Buddha Fest is a term that somebody came up with for the prison system, because each religion is allowed one annual festival. And nobody could quite agree or knew what an annual festival for our tradition would be, so it got the name Buddha Fest. And somehow that is works just fine. And so in one of the larger groups at Monroe this past Saturday, there was Buddha Fest, and I was not there, but they did something that we've done in the past, and it's the same way we celebrate Buddha's birthday. I don't know if you do it exactly this way. We celebrate it in April, but we have a pagoda that's just kind of this bare structure, and we decorate it with flowers, and we have the figure of the baby Buddha underneath, and we bathe the Buddha in sweet tea. Anyway, we brought this in to the prison and had to get the pagoda all checked out beforehand to make sure it wasn't, you know, didn't conceal any weapons, or, you know, the bamboo wasn't too sharp. I don't know. They let us in with some brass wire and some bamboo sticks anyway. And a bunch of flowers. So one of the guys really wanted to have an abundance of flowers, so he sent out ask for people to contribute to flowers, and many people did. And so this is his summary of the event. Between the donna given for flowers, a couple of big buckets full from Maria's garden, and a donation from QFC, there were a ton of flowers, over 20 varieties. The Buddha's pagoda had a massive color, plenty for the men to give a visiting wife or mother a bouquet. So that's one of the things that this does, is after the ceremony, the guys can take some flowers and present it to their visitors, because this is a time when visitors come. And they really have very little opportunity to do something like that, you know, because they don't have things to give. So it's one of the nice things about doing this in the prison. He goes on. Over and over, we hear emphatically from the residents that having people outside the prison who care about them gives them sanity, hope, and solace. Even more than the gift itself, the knowledge that our Sangha reached out to them was received with joy. And on Saturday, the guys kept saying that it was the happiest day of their year. The flowers did what flowers do. They were big and bright and vibrant, lighting up the whole place with generosity. So this guy's a good writer, I think. He does a nice job of presenting that. So this was this past week. And then, in reply from another pretty senior Sangha member, she says, "If there are any more reply all messages about this, could you remove me from the email, please? The man who terrorized and abused me is in prison there. And even thinking about Monroe Prison brings back a lot of bad memories. Thanks for your help." So these are two, you know, very authentic responses to this situation of men incarcerated at Monroe Prison. And, you know, how do we hold them both? How do we not say, oh, these guys are, well, we do say they're Buddhists, and yet they have done, some of them, some very harmful things, and people have been hurt by them, and people carry that hurt still. So I think it's good to recognize that we all carry hurt of some kind, and woundedness of some kind. And so we have to work with that, along with this idea of going beyond our small self. So some of us who have been hurt by men like this, it's probably not it's probably not a good practice to go in there. It's certainly not something where people should say, "Oh, I should be able to forgive them, right? I'm an aspiring bodhisattva. I should be bigger than this. I should go past that." I don't think human beings really are that way. At least not for many lifetimes of practice, shall we say. So we have this hurt, and we can open where we can open. And we can discover this insight that all of our liberation is intertwined in one situation or another. I was able to discover it in the prison because of kind of my privilege and protectiveness, probably, of growing up. I had not been abused. So this was an opening for me. Other people can have this experience elsewhere, I think. So I think it's important not to sweep away our own hurt, and not to expect ourselves to go beyond it. And it's important, to go beyond it. We shouldn't expect ourselves to get rid of it, wipe it away, but I think we also learn this practice to go beyond it. So that's a little tricky. That's kind of a tricky thing. But it seems to me that, and I've just kind of put it in this way recently, and maybe it will be helpful, maybe not, but that healing and this thing I'm calling liberation are separate things. So this liberation promotes healing in our lives, and healing promotes the practice of liberation. But the way I'm talking about it today, healing is about our own small wounded self, and liberation is about going beyond that. And both are important concerns. And so it seems to me today that having an idea that those are not the same thing is helpful, because sometimes we might have the idea that if we push really hard in practice and have this experience of liberation, that then all of our hurt will go away. And sometimes maybe we pretend that it has, but I don't think it does in that way. I think gradually healing happens, and gradually our ability, our practice of liberation increases. But the two are, I think it's helpful to keep, to think about the two separately, at least from my point of view. So our bodhisattva practice is not about telling ourselves that we should be perfect and all forgiving, but it's about finding the opportunity, the right opportunity for our own self to have this experience of going beyond ourselves. And for me, this was prison work. So as I see it, a bodhisattva holds boundaries to protect beings and also liberates beings from boundaries. And this is our paradox, if you will. I think it's the same thing that the Diamond Sutra presents. But bodhisattvas hold boundaries in order to protect beings and also liberate beings from boundaries. And the two are not mutually exclusive. I always forget to look at my watch at the beginning, so I don't know what time I started, so I don't know how long it's taken. But I will move along here. I noticed your English translation of the Bodhisattva vows says something like, beings are numberless, I vow to liberate them. And again, I think this is a problem for us, because what does that mean? I vow to liberate all beings, right? It seems impossible, it seems lofty, it seems like, how am I supposed to do that? And I like the way, I like your translation that uses the word liberate. It's the word I'm using today. Our translation still uses the word save, which I think is kind of difficult. And there is this notion of the bodhisattva as somebody who vows to gain awakening for the sake of all beings, and then does not leave birth and death until all beings are saved. And I think that's a little bit difficult for us, because I think we take it to mean I should get enlightened and then get everybody else enlightened too. And, you know, I'm already partly enlightened, so maybe I can go around and partly enlighten everybody else. And, you know, you get into trouble that way, I think. So it's not about acquiring something and reaching down to help others. It's not about, it's not even about, I don't think, this is another take on it. It could be that when I practice really hard and experience liberation, then all beings are liberated. And there's a sense of truth to that, because they are liberated from my conception of them, but I don't think that's enough either. Nor do I think it's enough to say, well, my delusions don't really matter, I should just go out and help other people because that's what matters. And then I just keep putting my delusions out there. So we have this kind of tricky idea of the bodhisattva and how all beings are liberated together. So I'm just encouraging us today to work with that. And one of the essential parts of that is you can't do it on your own. I think that's a good thing for us to remember. Although we can liberate other beings from our own ideas about them, which is pretty helpful, I think we need to go further than that. Well, in fact, I think in order to completely do that, we need other beings to interact with. There is a teaching from the Lotus Sutra that our tradition, our Soto tradition, makes quite a bit of, and I'm not sure about the Rinzai tradition, but that teaching is from the Lotus Sutra, and it's basically that only a Buddha together with another Buddha can manifest the truth, can penetrate the truth. So a Buddha can't even do it. A Buddha needs another Buddha in order to do it. And so that's really an encouragement to us to look for other Buddhas to help us manifest the truth. Norman Fisher puts this in a more narrative treatment. He says, the Buddha's message in this sutra was, now I am revealing a deeper truth, that the path, the teachings, the practice is much larger than I indicated before. Part of the Lotus Sutra is it's a Mahayana polemic, in a sense. In fact, it is infinite in scope, limitless, because beings are infinite and limitless. Although I defined it before, in truth, the path cannot be defined. No ordinary person could possibly know it, for it is beyond all knowing. Only a Buddha and a Buddha can understand it. Even a Buddha by himself or herself can't understand it. Only a Buddha and a Buddha can. Only through profound relationship, deep encounter, ineffable meeting, can we hope to appreciate the immense dimensions of our human life. So this practice is about Buddha meeting Buddha. And I think that's a nice way to talk about our practice in general, as Buddha meeting Buddha, moment to moment to moment. So to sum it up, I don't think it's not that we can't help others. I think at a certain point, it's the only way to help ourselves is to engage in this, what it means to actually be helpful to others. I don't think we acquire a realization. I think we gradually become more susceptible to realization. I think that I vow to liberate them, or I vow to save them, is really no different than I vow to allow them to awaken me. So beings are numberless. I vow to be open enough so that they will awaken me. That's how I like to think of that phrase, or at least add to that phrase in our vows. And then we just tip ourselves into the life of vow and do our best to practice together. Thank you.
This podcast has been brought to you by the Puget Sound Zen Center. Thanks so much for listening. To learn more about our community, you can visit our website at pszc.org.